gone before he saw him? Or was it Ghost who smelled him? Of late, Jon Snow sometimes felt as if he and the direwolf were one, even awake. The great white wolf appeared first, shaking off the snow. A few moments later, Tom was there.
"Wildlings," he told Jon softly, "in the grove."
Jon brought the riders to a halt. "How many?"
"I counted 9. No guards. Some dead might be, or sleeping. Most look to be women. One child, but there's a giant too, just the one that I saw. They've got a fire burning, smoke drifting through the trees. Fools."
9, and I have 7 and 10. 4 of his were green boys, though, and none were giants. Jon was not of a mind to fall back to the wall, however. "If the wildlings are still alive, it may be we can bring them in. And if they are dead, well, a corpse or two could be of use." "We'll continue on foot," he said, dropping lightly to the frozen ground. The snow was ankle-deep. "Rory, Pate, stay with the horses." He might have given that duty to the recruits, but they would need to be blooded soon enough. And this was as good a time as any. "Spread out and form a crescent. I want to close in on the grove from 3 sides. Keep the men to your right and left in sight, so the gaps do not widen. The snow should muffle our steps. Less chance of blood if we take them unawares." Night was falling fast. The shafts of sunlight had vanished when the last thin slice of the sun was swallowed beneath the western woods. The pink snowdrifts were going white again, the colour leaching out of them as the world darkened. The evening sky had turned the faded grey of an old cloak that had been washed too many times, and the first shy stars were coming out. Ahead he glimpsed a pale white trunk that could only be a weirwood, crowned with a head of dark red leaves. Jon Snow reached back and pulled Longclaw from his sheath. He looked to right and left, gave Saturn and Horse a nod, watched them pass it on to the men beyond. They rushed the grove together, kicking through drifts of old snow with no sound but their breathing. Ghost ran with them, a white shadow at John's side. The weirwoods rose in a circle around the edges of the clearing. There were 9, all roughly of the same age and size. Each one had a face carved into it, and no 2 faces were alike. Some were smiling, some were screaming, some were shouting at him. In the deepening glow, their eyes looked black, but in daylight they would be blood-red, Jon knew, eyes like ghosts. The fire in the centre of the grove was a small, sad thing. Ashes and embers and a few broken branches burning slow and smoky. Even then it had more life than the wildlings huddled near it. Only one of them reacted when Jon stepped from the brush. That was the child, who began to wail, clutching at his mother's ragged cloak. The woman raised her eyes and gasped. By then the grove was ringed by rangers, sliding past the bone-white trees, steel glinting in black-gloved hands, poised for slaughter. The giant was the last to notice him. He had been asleep, curled up by the fire. But something woke him. The child's cry, the sound of snow crunching beneath black boots, a sudden indrawn breath. When he stirred, it was as if a boulder had come to life. He heaved himself into a sitting position with a snort, pawing at his eyes with hands as big as hams to rub the sleep away, until he saw Iron Emmett, his sword shining in his hand. Roaring, he came leaping to his feet, and one of those huge hands closed around a maul and jerked it up. Ghost showed his teeth in answer. Jon grabbed the wolf by the scruff of the neck. "We want no battle here." His men could bring the giant down, he knew, but not without cost. Once blood was shed, the wildlings would join the fray. Most or all would die here, and some of his own brothers too. "This is a holy place.
Yield, and we—" The giant bellowed again, a sound that shook the leaves and the trees, and slammed his maul against the ground. The shaft of it was 6 feet of gnarled oak, the head a stone as big as a loaf of bread. The impact made the ground shake. Some of the other wildlings went scrambling for their own weapons. Jon Snow was about to reach for Longclaw when Leather spoke from the far side of the grove. His words sounded gruff and guttural, but Jon heard the music in it and recognized the old tongue. Leather spoke for a long while. When he was done, the giant answered. It sounded like growling, interspersed with grunts, and Jon could not understand a word of it. But Leathers pointed at the trees and said something else, and the giant pointed at the trees, ground his teeth, and dropped his maul.
"It's done," said Leathers. "They want no fight."
"Well done, but what did you tell him?"
"That they were our guards too, that we came to pray."
"We shall. Put away your steel, all of you. We will have no bloodshed here tonight." 9, Tom Barleycorn had said, and 9 there were, but 2 were dead, and 1 so weak he might have died by morning. The 6 who remained include the mother and child, 2 old men, a wounded thin in battered bronze, and 1 of the Hornfoot folk, his bare feet so badly frostbitten that John knew at a glance he would never walk again. Most had been strangers to one another when they came to the grove, he learned, subsequently. When Stannis broke Mance Rayder's host, they had fled into the woods to escape the carnage, wandered for a time, lost friends and kin to cold and starvation, and finally washed up here, too weak and weary to go on.
"The gods are here,"
one of the old men said.
"This was a good place to die as any."
"The wall is only a few hours south of here," said John. "Why not seek shelter there? Others yielded, even Mance." The wildlings exchanged looks. Finally one said, "We heard stories. The crows burned all them that yielded."
"Even Mance himself," the woman added.
"Melisandre," John thought, "you and your red god have much and more to answer for. All those who wish are welcome to return with us. There's food and shelter at Castle Black, and the wall to keep you safe from the things that haunt these woods. You have my word. No one will burn."
"A crow's word,"
the woman said, hugging her child close.
"But who's to say that you can keep it? Who are you?"
"Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, and the son of Eddard Stark of Winterfell." John turned to Tom Barleycorn. "Have Rory and Pate bring up the horses. I do not mean to stay here one moment longer than we must."
"As you say, my lord."
One last thing remained before they could depart, the thing they had come for. Arn Emmett called forth his charges, and as the rest of the company watched from a respectful distance, they knelt before the weirwoods. The last light of day was gone by then. The only light came from the stars above and the faint red glow of the dying fire in the centre of the grove. With their black hoods and thick black cowls, the 6 might have been carved from shadow. Their voices rose together, small against the vastness of the night. "Night gathers, and now my watch begins," they said, as thousands had said before them. Saturn's voice was sweet as song. Horses, hoarse and halting. Errands, a nervous squeak. "It shall not end until my death." "May those deaths be long in coming." Jon Snow sank to one knee in the snow. "Gods of my fathers, protect these men. And Arya too, my little sister, wherever she might be. I pray you, let Mance find her and bring her safe to me. I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children," the recruits promised, in voices that echoed back through years and centuries. "I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. I shall live and die
at my post. "Gods of the woods, grant me the strength to do the same," Jon Snow prayed silently. "Give me the wisdom to know what must be done, and the courage to do it." "I am the sword in the darkness," said the six, and it seemed to Jon as though their voices were changing, growing stronger, more certain. "I am the watcher on the walls. I am the fire that burns against the cold, the light that brings the dawn, the horn that wakes the sleepers, the shield that guards the realms of men." "The shield that guards the realms of men?" Ghost nuzzled up against his shoulder, and Jon draped an arm around him. He could smell horses' unwashed breeches, the sweet scent satin combed into his beard, the rank, sharp smell of fear, the giant's overpowering musk. He could hear the beating of his own heart. When he looked across the grove, at the woman with her child, the two greybeards, the hornfoot man with his mane feet, all he saw was men. "I pledge my life and honour to the Night's Watch for this night and all the nights to come." Jon Snow was the first unto his feet. "Rise now, as men of the Night's Watch." He gave Horse a hand to pull him up. The wind was rising. It was time to go. The journey back took much longer than the journey to the grove. The giant's pace was a ponderous one, despite the length and girth of those legs, and he was forever stopping to knock snow off low-hanging limbs with his maw. The woman rode double with Rory, her son with Tom Barleycorn, the old man with Horse and Satin. The Thin was frightened of the horses, however, and preferred to limp along despite his wounds. The hornfoot man could not sit a saddle, and had to be tied over the back of a garron like a sack of grain. So too the pale-faced crone, with their stick-thin limbs, whom they had not been able to rouse. They did the same with the two corpses, to the puzzlement of Iron Emmet. "They will only slow us, my lord," he said to John. "We should chop them up and burn them." "No," said John, "bring them. I have use for them." They had no moon to guide them home, and only now and then a patch of stars. The world was black and white and still. It was a long, slow, endless trek. The snow clung to their boots and breeches, and the wind rattled the pines and made their cloaks snap and swirl. Jon glimpsed the red wanderer above, watching them through the leafless branches of great trees as they made their way beneath. The thief, the free folk called it. The best time to steal a woman was when the thief was in the Moon Maid, Ygritte had always claimed. She never mentioned the best time to steal a giant or two dead men. It was almost dawn before they saw the wall again. A sentry's horn greeted them as they approached, sounding from on high like the cry of some huge, deep-throated bird, a single long blast that meant "Rangers returning." Big Little unslung his own war horn and gave answer. At the gate they had to wait a few moments before Dolorous Ed Tollett appeared to slide back the bolts and swing open the iron bars. When Ed caught sight of the ragged band of wildlings, he pursed his lips and gave the giant a long look.
"Might need some butter to slide that one through the tunnel, my lord. Shall I send someone to the larder?"
"Oh, I think he'll fit. Unbuttered." So he did, on hands and knees, crawling. A big boy, this one, 14 feet at least, even bigger than Mag the Mighty. Mag had died beneath this very ice, locked in mortal struggle with Donal Noy. A good man. The Watch had lost too many good men. Jon took Leathers aside.
"Take charge of him. You speak his tongue. See that he is fed, and find him a warm place by the fire. Stay with him. See that no one provokes him."
"Aye," Leathers hesitated, "my lord." The living wildlings Jon sent off to have their wounds and frostbites tended. Some hot food and warm clothes would restore most of them, he hoped. though the horned foot man was like to lose both feet. The corpses he consigned to the ice cells. Clydes had come and gone, John noted, as he was hanging his cloak on the peg beside the door. A letter had been left on the table in Isola. East Watch, or the Shadow Tower, he assumed at first glance. But the wax was gold, not black. The seal showed a stag's head within a flaming heart. Stannis! John cracked the hardened wax, flattened the roll of parchment, read, "A maester's hand, but the king's words." Stannis had taken Deepwood Mott, and the mountain clans had joined him. Flint, Norrie, Wall, Little, all. "And we had other help, unexpected but most welcome, from a daughter of Bear Island, Alisane Mormont, whose men name her the She-Bear, hid fighters inside a gaggle of fishing sloops and took the Iron Men unawares where they lay off the strand. Greyjoy's longships are burned or taken, her crew slain or surrendered. The captains, knights, notable warriors, and others of high birth, we shall ransom or make other use of. The rest I mean to hang." The Night's Watch was sworn to take no side in the quarrels and conflicts of the realm. Nonetheless, Jon Snow could not help but feel a certain satisfaction. He read on, "More Northmen coming in as word spreads of our victory. Fisher folk, free riders, hillmen, crofters from the deep of the Wolf's Wood, and villagers who fled their homes along the stony shore to escape the Iron Men, survivors from the battle outside the gates of Winterfell, men once sworn to the Hornwoods, the Serwins, and the Tallhearts. We are 5,000 strong, as I write, our numbers swelling every day, and word has come to us that Roose Bolton moves toward Winterfell with all his power, there to wed his bastard to your half-sister. He must not be allowed to restore the castle to its former strength. We march against him. Arn of Carstock and Mors Umber will join us. I will save your sister, if I can, and find a better match for her than Ramsay Snow. You and your brothers must hold the wall until I can return." It was signed in a different hand. "Done in the light of Lord, under the sign and seal of Stannis of House Baratheon, the first of his name, King of the Andals, the Rhoynar, and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms and Protector of the Realm." The moment John set the letter aside, the parchment curled up again, as if eager to protect its secrets. He was not at all sure how he felt about what he had just read. Battles had been fought at Winterfell before, but never one without a Stark on one side or the other. "The castle is a shell," he said. "Not Winterfell, but the ghost of Winterfell." It was painful just to think of it, much less say the words aloud. And still, he wondered how many men old Crowfood would bring to the fray, and how many swords Arn of Carstock would be able to conjure up. Half the Umbers would be across the field with Horsebane, fighting beneath the flayed man of the Dreadfort, and the greater part of the strength of both houses had gone south with Rob, never to return. Even ruined, Winterfell itself would confer a considerable advantage on whoever held it. Robert Baratheon would have seen that at once and moved swiftly to secure the castle, with the forced marches and midnight rides for which he had been famous. Would his brother be as bold? Not likely. Stannis was a deliberate commander, and his host was a half-digested stew of clansmen, Southron knights, kingsmen and queensmen, salted with a few northern lords. He should move on Winterfell swiftly or not at all, John thought. It was not his place to advise the king, but he glanced at the letter again. "I will save your sister if I can." Surprisingly tender sentiment from Stannis, though undercut by that final brutal "if I can," and the addendum "and find a better match for her than Ramsay Snow." But what if Arya was not there to be saved? What if Lady Melisandre's flames had told it true? Could his sister truly have escaped such captors? How would she do that? Arya was always quick and clever, but in the end she's just a little girl, and Roose Bolton is not the sort who would be careless for the prize of such great worth. What if Bolton never had his sister? This wedding could well be just some ruse to lure Stannis into a trap. Eddard Stark had never had any reason to complain of the Lord of the Dreadfort, so far as John knew. But even so, he had never trusted him, with his whispery voice and his pale, pale eyes. A grey girl on a dying horse, fleeing from her marriage. On the strength of those words, he had loosed Mance Rayder and 6 spear wives on the north.
"Young ones and pretty," Mance had said.
The unburnt king supplied some names, and Dolorous Ed had done the rest, smuggling them from Molestown. It seemed like madness now. He might have done better to strike down Mance the moment he revealed himself. John had a certain grudging admiration for the late king beyond the wall, but the man was an oath-breaker and a turncloak. He had even less trust in Melisandre. Yet somehow here he was, pinning his hopes on them. "All to save my sister. But the men of the Night's Watch have no sisters." When John had been a boy at Winterfell, his hero had been the young dragon, the boy king who had conquered Dorne at the age of 14. Despite his bastard birth, or perhaps because of it, Jon Snow had dreamed of leading men to glory, just as King Daeron had, of growing up to be a conqueror. Now he was a man grown, and the wall was his. Yet all he had were doubts. He could not even seem to conquer those.
Samwell. The Cinnamon Wind was a swan ship out of Tall Trees Town on the Summer Isles, where men were black, women were wanton, and even the gods were strange. She had no septon aboard her to lead them in the prayers of passing, so the task fell to Samwell Tarly, somewhere off the sun-scorched southern coast of Dorne. Sam donned his blacks to say the words, though the afternoon was warm and muggy with nary a breath of wind. "He was a good man," he began, but as soon as he had said the words he knew that they were wrong. "No, he was a great man, a maester of the citadel, chained and sworn brother of the Night's Watch, ever faithful. When he was born, they named him for a hero who had died too young, but though he lived a long, long time, his own life was no less heroic. No man was wiser or gentler or kinder. At the wall, a dozen lords commander came and went during his years of service, but he was always there to counsel them. He counseled kings as well. He could have been a king himself, but when they offered him the crown, he told them they should give it to his younger brother. How many men would do that?" Sam felt the tears welling in his eyes and knew he could not go on much longer. "He was the blood of the dragon, but now his fire has gone out. He was Aemon Targaryen, and now his watch is ended." "And now his watch is ended," Gilly murmured after him, rocking the babe in her arms. Kodja Mo echoed her in the common tongue of Westeros, then repeated the words in the summer tongue for Zondo and her father and the rest of the assembled crew. Sam hung his head and began to weep, his sobs so loud and wrenching that they made his whole body shake. Gilly came and stood beside him and let him cry upon her shoulder. There were tears in her eyes as well. The air was moist and warm and dead calm, and the cinnamon wind was adrift upon a deep blue sea, far beyond the sight of land. "Black Sam said good words," Zondo said. "Now we drink his life." He shouted something in the summer tongue, and a cask of spiced rum was rolled up onto the afterdeck and breached, so those on watch might down a cup in the memory of the old blind dragon. The crew had known him only a short while, but Summer Islanders revered the elderly and celebrated their dead. Sam had never drunk rum before. The liquor was strange and heady, sweet at first, but with a fiery aftertaste that burned his tongue. He was tired, so tired. Every muscle he had was aching, and there were other aches in places where Sam hadn't known he had muscles. His knees were stiff, his hands covered with fresh new blisters and raw sticky patches of skin where the old blisters had burst. Yet between them, rum and sadness seemed to wash his hurts away. "If only we could have gotten him to Old Town, the Archmaesters might have saved him," he told Gilly as they sipped their rum on the Cinnamon Wind's high forecastle. "The healers of the Citadel are the best in the Seven Kingdoms. For a while I thought, I hoped." On Braavos, it had seemed possible that Aemon might recover. Zondo's talk of dragons had almost seemed to restore the old man to himself. That night he ate every bite Sam put before him. "No one ever looked for a girl," he said. "It was a prince that was promised, not a princess. Rhaegar, I thought." The smoke was from the fire that devoured Summer Hall on the day of his birth, the salt from the tears shed for those who died. "He shared my belief when he was young, but later he became persuaded that it was his own son who fulfilled the prophecy, for a comet had been seen above King's Landing on the night Aegon was conceived, and Rhaegar was certain the Bleeding Star had to be a comet. What fools we were who thought ourselves so wise. The error crept in from the translation. Dragons are neither male nor female. Bath saw the truth of that, but now one and now the other, as changeable as flame. The language misled us all for 1,000 years. Daenerys is the one, born amidst salt and smoke. The dragons prove it. Just talking of her seemed to make him stronger. I must go to her. I must. Would that I was even 10 years younger. The old man had been so determined that he had even walked up the plank onto the Cinnamon Wind on his own two legs after Sam made arrangements for their passage. He had already given his sword and scabbard to Zondo to repay the big mate for the feathered cloak he'd ruined, saving Sam from drowning. The only things of value that still remained to them were the books they had brought from the vaults of Castle Black. Sam parted with them glumly. "They were meant for the Citadel," he said when Zondo asked him what was wrong. When the mate translated those words, the captain laughed. "Kuhuromo says the Grey Men will be having these books still," Zondo told him. "Only they will be buying them from Kuhuromo. The maesters give good silver for books they are not having, and sometimes red and yellow gold." The captain wanted Aemon's chain as well, but there Sam had refused. It was a great shame for any maester to surrender his chain, he had explained. Zondo had to go over that part 3 times before Kuhuromo accepted it. By the time the dealing was done, Sam was down to his boots and blacks and small clothes, and the broken horn Jon Snow had found on the Fist of First Men. "I had no choice," he told himself. "We could not stay on Braavos, and short of theft or beggary, there was no other way to pay for passage." He would have counted it cheap at thrice the price, if only they had gotten Maester Aemon safe to Old Town. Their passage south had been a stormy one, however, and every gale took its toll on the old man's strength and spirits. At Pentos, he asked to be brought up onto deck so Sam might paint a picture of the city for him with words. But that was the last time he left the captain's bed. Soon after that, his wits began to wander once again. By the time the Cinnamon Wind swept past the Bleeding Tower into Tyrosh Harbor, Aemon no longer spoke of trying to find a ship to take him east. Instead, his talk turned back to Old Town and the Archmaesters of the Citadel. "You must tell them, Sam," he said. "The Archmaesters, you must make them understand. The men who were at the Citadel when I was have been dead for 50 years. These others never knew me. My letters in Old Town. They must have read like the ravings of an old man whose wits had fled. You must convince them where I could not. Tell them, Sam. Tell them how it is upon the wall, the whites and the white walkers, the creeping cold. I will, Sam promised. I will add my voice to yours, Maester. We will both tell them, the two of us together. No, the old man said, it must be you. Tell them, the prophecy, my brother's dream. Lady Melisandre has misread the signs. Stannis has some of the dragon blood in him, yes. His brothers did as well. Rael, Egg's little girl. She was how they came by it. Their father's mother. She used to call me Uncle Maester when she was a little girl. I remembered that, so I allowed myself to hope. Perhaps I wanted to. We all deceive ourselves when we want to believe. Melisandre, most of all, I think. The sword is wrong. She has to know that. Light without heat. An empty glamour. The sword is wrong. And the false light can only lead us deeper into darkness, Sam. Daenerys is our hope. Tell them that at the Citadel. Make them listen. They must send her a maester. Daenerys must be counseled, taught, protected. For all these years I've lingered, waiting, watching. And now that the day has dawned, I am too old. I am dying, Sam. Tears ran from his blind white eyes at that admission. Death should hold no fear for a man as old as me, but it does. Isn't that silly? It is always dark where I am, so why should I fear the darkness? Yet I cannot help but wonder what will follow when the last warmth leaves my body. Will I feast forever in the Father's golden hall, as the Septons say? Will I talk with the Egg again? Find Daeron, whole and happy, hear my sisters singing to their children. What if the Horse Lords have the truth of it? Will I ride through the night sky forever on a stallion made of flame? Or must I return again to this vale of sorrow? Who can say, truly? Who has been beyond the wall of death to see? Only the wights, and we know what they are like. We know. There was little and less that Sam could say to that, but he had given the old man what little comfort he could. And Gilly came in afterward and sang a song for him, a nonsense song that she learned from some of Craster's other wives. It made the old man smile and helped him go to sleep. That had been one of his last good days. After that, the old man spent more time sleeping than awake, curled up beneath a pile of furs in the captain's cabin. Sometimes he would mutter in his sleep. When he woke, he'd call for Sam, insisting that he had to tell him something. But oft as not, he would have forgotten what he meant to say by the time that Sam arrived. Even when he did recall, his talk was all a jumble. He spoke of dreams and never named the dreamer. Of a glass candle that could not be lit, and eggs that would not hatch. He said the Sphinx was the riddle, not the riddler, whatever that meant. He asked Sam to read for him from a book by Septon Barth, whose writings had been burned during the reign of Balor the Blessed. Once he woke up weeping. "The dragon must have three heads," he wailed, "but I am too old and frail to be one of them. I should be with her, showing her the way. But my body has betrayed me." As the cinnamon wind made her way through the stepstones, Maester Aemon forgot Sam's name oft as not. Some days he took him for one of his dead brothers. He was too frail for such a long voyage, Sam told Gilly on the forecastle, after another sip of the rum. John should have seen that. Aemon was 102 years old. He should never have been sent to sea. If he had stayed at Castle Black, he might have lived another 10 years. Or else she might have burned him, the Red Woman. Even here, 1,000 leagues from the wall, Gilly was reluctant to say Lady Melisandre's name aloud. She wanted king's blood for her fires. Val knew she did. Lord Snow, too. That was why they made me take Dalla's babe away and leave my own behind in his place. Maester Aemon went to sleep and didn't wake up. But if he had stayed, she would have burned him. He will still burn, Sam thought miserably. Only now I have to do it. The Targaryens always gave their fallen to the flames. K'huro Mo would not allow a funeral pyre aboard the Cinnamon Wind, so Aemon's corpse had been stuffed inside a cask of black belly rum to preserve it until the ship reached Old Town. "The night before he died, he asked if he might hold the babe," Gilly went on. "I was afraid he might drop him, but he never did. He rocked him and hummed a song for him, and Dalla's boy reached up and touched his face. The way he pulled his lip, I thought he might be hurting him, but it only made the old man laugh." She stroked Sam's hand. "We could name the little one Maester, if you like. When he's old enough, not now. We could." "Maester is not a name. You could call him Aemon, though." Gilly thought about that. "Dalla brought him forth during battle as the sword sang all around her. That should be his name. Aemon Battleborn. Aemon Steelsong. A name even my lord father might like. A warrior's name." The boy was Mance Raider's son and Craster's grandson after all. He had none of Sam's craven blood. "Yes, call him that. When he is two," she promised, "not before." "Where is the boy?" Sam thought to ask. Between rum and sorrow, it had taken him that long to realize that Gilly did not have the babe with her. "Koja has him. I asked her to take him for a while." "Oh." Koja Mo was the captain's daughter, taller than Sam and slender as a spear, with skin as black and smooth as polished jet. She captained the ship's red archers, too, and pulled a double-curved golden heart bow that could send a shaft 400 yards. When the pirates had attacked them in the Stepstones, Koja's arrows had slain a dozen of them, whilst Sam's own shafts were falling in the water. The only thing Koja Mo loved better than her bow was bouncing Dalla's boy upon her knee and singing to him in the summer tongue. The wildling prince had become the darling of all the women in the crew, and Gilly seemed to trust them with him, as she had never trusted any man. "That was kind of Koja," Sam said. "I was afraid of her at first," said Gilly. "She was so black, and her teeth were so big and white. I was afraid she was a beastling or a monster, but she's not. She's good. I like her." "I know you do." For most of her life, the only man Gilly had known had been the terrifying Craster. The rest of her world had been female. Men frighten her, but women don't, Sam realized. He could understand that. Back at Horn Hill, he had preferred the company of girls as well. His sisters had been kind to him, and though the other girls would sometimes taunt him, cruel words were easier to shrug off than the blows and buffets he got from the other castle boys. Even now on the Cinnamon Wind, Sam felt more comfortable with Koja Mo than with her father, though that might be because she spoke the common tongue and he did not. "I like you too, Sam," whispered Gilly, "and I like this drink. It tastes like fire." "Yes," Sam thought, "a drink for dragons." Their cups were empty, so he went over to the cask and filled them once again. The sun was low in the west, he saw, swollen to thrice its proper size. Its ruddy light made Gilly's face seem flushed and red. They drank a cup to Koja Mo, and one to Dalla's boy, and one to Gilly's babe, back on the wall. And after that, nothing would do but to drink two cups for Aemon of House Targaryen. "May the father judge him justly," Sam said, sniffing. The sun was almost gone by the time they were done with Maester Aemon. Only a long, thin line of red still glowed upon the western horizon like a slash across the sky. Gilly said that the drink was making the ships spin round, so Sam helped her down the ladder to the women's quarters in the bow of the ship. There was a lantern hanging just inside the cabin, and he managed to bang his head on it going in. "Ow!" he said, and Gilly said, "Are you hurt? Let me see." She leaned close and kissed his mouth. Sam found himself kissing her back. "I said the words," he thought, but her hands were tugging at his blacks, pulling at the laces of his breeches. He broke off the kiss long enough to say, "We can't." But Gilly said, "We can," and covered his mouth with her own again. The Cinnamon Wind was spinning all around them, and he could taste the rum on Gilly's tongue, and the next thing her breasts were bare and he was touching them. "I said the words," Sam thought again, but one of her nipples found its way between his lips. It was pink and hard, and when he sucked on it her milk filled his mouth, mingling with the taste of rum, and he had never tasted anything so fine and sweet and good. If I do this, I am no better than Darian, Sam thought, but it felt too good to stop. And suddenly his cock was out, jutting upward from his breeches like a fat pink mast. It looked so silly, standing there, that he might have laughed. But Gilly pushed him back onto her pallet, hiked her skirts up around her thighs, and lowered herself onto him with a little whimpery sound. That was even better than her nipples. "She's so wet," he thought, gasping. "I never knew a woman could get so wet down there." "I am your wife now," she whispered, sliding up and down on him. And Sam groaned and thought, "No, no, you can't be. I said the words. I said the words." But the only word he said was, "Yes." Afterwards, she went to sleep with her arms around him and her face across his chest. Sam needed sleep as well, but he was drunk on rum and mother's milk and Gilly. He knew he ought to crawl back to his own hammock in the men's cabin, but she felt so good, curled up against him, that somehow he could not move. Others came in, men and women both, and he listened to them, kissing and laughing and mating with one another. Summer Islanders, that's how they mourn. They answer death with life. Sam had read that somewhere a long time ago. He wondered if Gilly knew, if Kojimo had told her what to do. He breathed the fragrance of her hair and stared at the lantern swinging overhead. "Even the crone herself could not lead me safely out of this. The best thing he could do would be to slip away and jump into the sea. If I'm drowned, no one need ever know that I shamed myself and broke my vows, and Gilly can find herself a better man, one who is not some big, fat coward." He awoke the next morning in his own hammock in the men's cabin, with Zondo bellowing about the wind. "Wind is up," the mate kept shouting. "Wake and work, Black Sam, wind is up." What Zondo lacked in vocabulary, he made up for in volume. Sam rolled from his hammock to his feet and regretted it at once. His head was fit to split. One of the blisters on his palm had torn open in the night, and he felt as if he were about to retch. Zondo had no mercy, though, so all that Sam could do was struggle back into his blacks. He found them on the deck beneath his hammock, all bundled up in one damp heap. He sniffed at them to see how foul they were, and inhaled the smell of salt and sea and tar, wet canvas and mildew, fruit and fish and black-belly rum, strange spices and exotic woods, and a heady bouquet of his own dried sweat. But Gilly's smell was on them too, the clean smell of her hair and the sweet smell of her milk, and that made him glad to wear them. He would have given much and more for warm, dry socks, though. Some sort of fungus had begun to grow between his toes. The chest of books had not been near enough to buy passage for four from Bravos to Old Town. The cinnamon wind was short-handed, however, so Kuhurumo had agreed that he would take them, provided that they worked their way. When Sam had protested that Maester Aemon was too weak, the boy a babe in arms, and Gilly terrified of the sea, Zondo only laughed. "Black Sam is big fat man. Black Sam will work for four." If truth be told, Sam was so fumble-fingered that he doubted he was even doing the work of one good man, but he did try. He scrubbed decks and rubbed them smooth with stones. He hauled on anchor chains. He coiled rope and hunted rats. He sewed up torn sails, patched leaks with bubbling hot tar, boned fish and chopped fruit for the cook. Gilly tried as well. She was better in the rigging than Sam was, though from time to time the sight of so much empty water still made her close her eyes. "Gilly," Sam thought, "what am I going to do with Gilly?" It was a long, hot, sticky day, made longer by his pounding head. Sam busied himself with ropes and sails and the other tasks that Zondo set him, and tried not to let his eyes wander to the cask of rum that held old Maester Aemon's body, or to Gilly. He could not face the wildling girl right now, not after what they'd done last night. When she came up on deck, he went below. When she went forward, he went aft. When she smiled at him, he turned away, feeling wretched. "I should have jumped into the sea whilst she was still asleep," he thought. "I have always been a craven, but I was never an oath-breaker till now." If Maester Aemon had not died, Sam could have asked him what to do, If Jon Snow had been aboard, or even Pip and Gren, he might have turned to them. Instead he had Zondo. Zondo would not understand what I was saying, or if he did, he'd just tell me to fuck the girl again. Fuck had been the first word of the common tongue that Zondo had learned, and he was very fond of it. He was fortunate that the Cinnamon Wind was so big. Aboard the Blackbird, Gilly could have run him down in hardly any time at all. Swan ships, the great vessels from the Summer Isles, were called in the Seven Kingdoms, for their billowing white sails and for their figureheads, most of which depicted birds. Large as they were, they rode the waves with a grace that was all their own. With a good brisk wind behind them, the Cinnamon Wind could outrun any galley, though she was helpless when becalmed, and she offered plenty of places for a craven to hide. Near the end of Sam's watch, he was finally cornered. He was climbing down a ladder when Zondo seized him by the collar. "Black Sam, come with Zondo," he said, dragging him across the deck and dumping him at the feet of Kojimo. Far off to the north, a haze was visible low on the horizon. Koja pointed at it. "There is the coast of Dawn, sand and rocks and scorpions, and no good anchorage for hundreds of leagues. You can swim there if you like, and walk to Old Town. You will need to cross the deep desert and climb some mountains and swim the Torrentine, or else you could go to Gili." "You do not understand. Last night we honored your dead and the gods who made you both. Zondo did the same. I had the child, else I would have been with him. All you Westerosi make a shame of loving. There is no shame in loving. If your Septons say there is, your seven gods must be demons. In the Isles, we know better. Our gods gave us legs to run with, noses to smell with, hands to touch and feel. What mad, cruel god would give a man eyes and tell him he must forever keep them shut and never look at all the beauty in the world? Only a monster god, a demon of the darkness." Koja put her hand between Sam's legs. "The gods gave you this for a reason, too. For, what is your Westerosi word?" "Fucking," Zondo offered helpfully. "Yes, for fucking. For the giving of pleasure and the making of children. There is no shame in that." Sam backed away from her. "I took a vow. I will take no wife and father no children. I said the words." "She knows the words you said. She is a child in some ways. But she is not blind. She knows why you wear the black, why you go to Old Town. She knows she cannot keep you. She wants you for a little while, is all. She lost her father and her husband, her mother and her sisters, her home, her world. All she has is you and the bib. So you go to her or swim?" Sam looked despairingly at the haze that marked the distant shoreline. He could never swim so far, he knew. He went to Gilly. "What we did. If I could take a wife, I would sooner have you than any princess or high-born maiden, but I can't. I am still a crow. I said the words, Gilly. I went with John into the woods and said the words before a heart tree. The trees watch over us," Gilly whispered, brushing the tears from his cheeks. "In the forest. They see all, but there are no trees here. Only water, Sam. Only water." Circe. The day had been cold and grey and wet. It had poured all morning, and even when the rain stopped that afternoon, the clouds refused to part. They never saw the sun. Such wretched weather was enough to discourage even the little queen. Instead of riding with her hens and their retinue of guardsmen and admirers, she spent all day in the maiden vault with her hens, listening to the blue bard sing. Circe's own day was little better till evenfall. As the grey sky began to fade to black, they told her that the sweet Circe had come in on the evening tide, and that Aurin Waters was without, begging audience. The queen sent for him at once. As soon as he strode into her solar, she knew his tidings were good. "Your grace," he said with a broad smile, "Dragonstone is yours." "How splendid." She took his hands and kissed him on the cheeks. "I know Tommen will be pleased as well. This will mean that we can release Lord Redwine's fleet and drive the Iron Men from the shields. The news from the Reach seemed to grow more dire with every raven. The Iron Men had not been content with their new rocks, it seemed. They were raiding up the Mandarin strength and had gone so far as to attack the Arbor and the smaller islands that surrounded it. The Red Wines had kept no more than a dozen warships in their home waters, and all those had been overwhelmed, taken, or sunk. And now there were reports that this madman, who called himself Euron Crow's Eye, was even sending longships up Whispering Sounds towards Old Town. Lord Paxter was taking on provisions for the voyage home when Sweet Circe raised sail. Lord Waters reported, "I would imagine that by now his main fleet has put to sea. Let us hope they enjoy a swift voyage and better weather than today." The Queen drew Waters down into the window seat beside her. "Do we have Sir Loras to thank for this triumph?" His smile vanished. "Some will say so, Your Grace." "Some?" She gave him a quizzical look. "Not you?" "I never saw a braver knight," Waters said, but he turned what could have been a bloodless victory into a slaughter. 1,000 men are dead, or near enough to make no matter. Most of them are own, and not just common men, Your Grace, but knights and young lords, the best and the bravest. And Sir Loras himself? He will make 1,001. They carried him inside the castle after the battle, but his wounds are grievous. He has lost so much blood that the maesters will not even leech him. Oh, how sad. Tommen will be heartbroken. He did so admire our gallant knight of flowers. The small folk, too, her admiral said, will have maidens weeping into their wine all across the realm when Loras dies. He was not wrong, the queen knew. 3,000 small folk had crowded through the mud gate to see Sir Loras off the day he sailed, and 3 of every 4 were women. The sight had only served to fill her with contempt. She had wanted to scream at them that they were sheep, to tell them that all that they could ever hope to get from Loras Tyrell was a smile and a flower. Instead, she had proclaimed him the boldest knight in the 7 kingdoms, and smiled as Tommen presented him with a jeweled sword to carry into battle. The king had given him a hug as well, which had not been part of Circe's plans. But it made no matter now. She could afford to be generous. Loras Tyrell was dying. "Tell me," Circe commanded. "I want to know all of it from the beginning to the end." The room had grown dark by the time that he was done. The queen lit some candles and sent Dorcas to the kitchens to bring them up some bread and cheese and a bit of boiled beef with horseradish. As they supped, she bid Auraine to tell the tale again, so she would remember all the details correctly. "I do not want our precious Marjorie to hear these tidings from a stranger, after all," she said. "I will tell her myself." "Your Grace is kind," said Waters with a smile. A wicked smile, the queen thought. Auraine did not resemble Prince Rhaegar as much as she had thought. He has the hair, but so do half the whores in Lys, if the tales are true. Rhaegar was a man. This is a sly boy, no more. Useful in his way, though. Marjorie was in the maiden vault, sipping wine and trying to puzzle out some new game from Volantis with her 3 cousins. Though the hour was late, the guards admitted Circe at once. "Your Grace," she began, "it is best you hear the news from me. Auraine is back from Dragonstone. Your brother is a hero." "I always knew he was." Marjorie did not seem surprised. Why should she? She expected this from the moment Loras begged for the command. Yet by the time Circe had finished with her tale, tears glistened on the cheeks of the younger queen. Redwine had miners working to drive a tunnel underneath the castle walls, but that was too slow for the Knight of Flowers. No doubt he was thinking of your Lord Father's people suffering on the shields. Lord Waters says he ordered the assault not half a day after taking command, after Lord Stannis's castellan refused his offer to settle the siege between them in single combat. Loras was the first one through the breach when the ram broke the castle gates. He rode straight into the dragon's mouth, they say, all in white, and swinging his morning star about his head, slaying left and right. Mega Tyrell was sobbing openly by then. How did he die? She asked. Who killed him? No one man has that honor, said Circe. Solaris took a quarrel through the thigh and another through the shoulder, but he fought on gallantly, though the blood was streaming from him. Later he suffered a mace blow that broke some ribs. After that, but no, I would spare you the worst of it. Tell me, said Marjorie, I command it. Command it? Circe paused a moment, then decided she would let that pass. The defenders fell back to an inner keep once the curtain wall was taken. Loras led the attack there as well. He was doused with boiling oil. Lady Alla turned white as chalk and ran from the room. The maesters are doing all they can, Lord Waters assures me, but I fear your brother is too badly burned. Circe took Marjorie in her arms to comfort her. He saved the realm. When she kissed the little queen upon the cheek, she could taste the salt of her tears. Jamie will enter all his deeds in the White Book, and the singers will sing of him for 1,000 years. Marjorie wrenched free of her embrace so violently that Circe almost fell. Dying is not dead, she said. No, but the maesters say, dying is not dead. I only want to spare you. I know what you want. Get out. Now you know how I felt the night my Joffrey died. She bowed, her face a mask of cool courtesy. Sweet daughter, I am so sad for you. I will leave you with your grief. Lady Merryweather did not appear that night, and Circe found herself too restless to sleep. If Lord Tywin could see me now, he would know he had his heir, an heir worthy of the Rock, she thought, as she lay abed with Jocelyn Swift snoring softly into the other pillow. Marjorie would soon be weeping the bitter tears she should have wept for Joffrey. Mace Tyrell might weep as well, but she had given him no cause to break with her. What had she done, after all, but honour Loras with her trust? He had requested the command on bended knee whilst half her court looked on. When he dies, I must raise a statue of him somewhere and give him a funeral such as King's Landing has never seen. The small folk would like that. So would Tommen. Mace may even thank me, poor man. As for his lady mother, if the gods are good, this news will kill her. The sunrise was the prettiest that Circe had seen in years. Taena appeared soon thereafter and confessed to having spent the night consoling Marjorie and her ladies, drinking wine and crying and telling tales of Loras. Marjorie is still convinced he will not die, she reported, as the queen was dressed for court. She plans to send her own maester to look after him. The cousins are praying for the mother's mercy. I shall pray as well. On the morrow, come with me to Baelor Sept, and we will light 100 candles for a gallant knight of flowers. She turned to her handmaid. Dorcas, bring my crown, the new one, if you please. It was lighter than the old, pale spun gold set with emeralds that sparkled when she turned her head. There are 4 come about the imp this morning, Sir Osmond said, when Jocelyn admitted him. 4? The queen was pleasantly surprised. A steady stream of informers had been making their way to the Red Keep, claiming knowledge of Tyrion, but 4 in one day was unusual. Aye, said Osmond, one brought a head for you. I will see him first. Bring him to my solar. This time let there be no mistakes. Let me be avenged at long last, so Joff can rest in peace. The Septon said that the number 7 was sacred to the gods. If so, perhaps this 7th head would bring her the balm her soul desired. The man proved to be Tyroshi, short and stout and sweaty, with an unctuous smile that reminded her of Varys, and a forked beard dyed green and pink. Circe misliked him on sight, but was willing to overlook his flaws if he actually had Tyrion's head inside the chest he carried. It was cedar, inlaid with ivory in a pattern of vines and flowers with hinges and clasps of white gold. A lovely thing, but the queen's only interest lay in what might be within. It is big enough, at least. Tyrion had a grotesquely large head for one so small and stunted. Your grace, the Tyroshi murmured, bowing low, I see you are as lovely as the tales. Even beyond the narrow sea we have heard of your great beauty, and the grief that tears your gentle heart. No man can restore your brave young son to you.